Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is July 22nd, 2016. For years, I thought I was in the information business. I gathered all the latest and greatest information from the fields of energy, the environment, and the economy. I carefully assembled it and presented it to many people, thinking that they would somehow see things differently as a result, and more importantly, take different actions in their lives as a result. Most didn't. By which I mean 99% or more were unchanged by what I considered really earth-shattering information about the trajectory of humanity over the next couple of decades. So I had to sit back, scratch my head, and take things from an entirely different angle. If information was perhaps necessary but insufficient to lead to personal change, what was still missing? After a lengthy detour through such fields as behavioral economics, psychology, and addiction research, among others, I had my answer. Beliefs. Beliefs stood in the way. To effectively communicate challenging material, I had to be aware of the role of beliefs in causing people to either accept or reject information, no matter how good that information was. Further, the way in which emotions and beliefs are intertwined was a complication. Now, given where we are in this crazy world today, with more predicaments than you could sanely shake a stick at, and given how hard it is to dislodge cultural beliefs that stand in the way of progress, one could be forgiven for wondering if there's any hope left. But there is. There always is. Our surprising messenger of hope today is Dr. Michael Shermer, the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, a regular contributor to Time.com, and presidential fellow at Chapman University. His new book is The Moral Arc: How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Towards Truth, Justice, and Freedom. He is also the author of The Believing Brain: From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths. These are both books that I'm really looking forward to diving into here today. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start here before we dive into your books. How did you come to be the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine? I'm wondering, what events motivated you to place your energies there?
Well, a couple things. First, I'm a science guy. I have training in the social sciences, experimental psychology in particular, and my PhD is in the history of science. So I have a broad education in a lot of different sciences and in the scientific method itself. So when I was in graduate school, first time in the late 70s, there was much interest, scientific interest, in the paranormal, ESP, psychic power, telekinesis, that sort of thing, life after death and whatnot. And there were scientists doing this research, so I thought there might be something to it since I was just a grad student, so, you know, what do I know? And so I was interested in it that way. And then I was also interested in the intersection between science and culture, science and politics, when I was doing research on the creationist movement in the 1980s when I was in my history of science doctoral program. And, you know, why it is that people could not accept evolutionary theory. I mean, it was so obviously true. It was, you know, centuries worth of evidence piled up in support of it. And yet there was this, you know, pocket of pretty much only American fundamentalist religious people who would not accept it. So it was obvious to me there was some cultural, political, religious, whatever motive behind that. So that got me interested then in motivated reasoning and the psychology of belief. So when we founded Skeptic Magazine in the early 90s, 92, as a science magazine that would specialize in areas that other science magazines didn't cover. So for example, for my monthly column in Scientific American called Skeptic, I would deal with, say, the climate deniers, whereas scientists in the magazine as a whole would deal with climate science. So I would deal with, you know, kind of the margins, the fringes, the areas that have to do with belief, for example. Well, and so that you know, that's sort of the background.
Well, if we could spend just a little time there, I know you've got a new book out, but I'd like to go back to The Believing Brain for a second because it's so important to what you're saying and to my own work. Well, what is a belief in your words, and how important are they in our daily lives?
Beliefs are kind of broken down into either thoughts or language by which we communicate. And they're the things that we hold to be true about any number of different areas, anything simple from, you know, sort of folk physics, like, you know, if I drop something, it'll fall. You know, if I, you know, if I jump off a cliff, I will die. You know, my car will do this and that, just basic stuff. But, you know, folk biology, you know, that organisms are alive and have an essence to them and they'll act a certain way in a predictable manner. You know, and then, you know, like folk economics, folk politics, just the way we think that the world works by our intuitions. Then, and those we evolved. You know, there's good reasons why, for example, people are uncomfortable with economic inequality, because our species evolved in these tiny groups, these small bands of hunter-gatherers that had very few resources at all, and there was much transparency in the group because, you know, there's not much else to do, and so everybody could see how much everybody had, which was not much. So that's what we're used to. So when there's cumulative wealth, when there's not transparency, it feels like something's up, like somebody's cheating the system, somebody's getting too much. That would be an example of folk economics that runs counter to how we know markets work. And so that much of the modern world is counterintuitive to our intuitions about how the world works.
Well, I think implicit in that is that, you know, what we're seeing is what we're getting. It's certainly true that humans are motivated by incentives, and we have very complex systems, and some people have better access to the complexities of those systems. I would dare say that in my experience, and it's fairly considerable at this point, we do not have a level playing field when it comes to markets at this point in time. As much as people would like to believe in free markets, my direct experience is they're not free. We have asymmetries of information, co-locations of servers, a variety of things that are clearly say there is a something less than a level playing field from time to time, but I will agree with you that as primates, we're wired for fairness. It's part of our social package, our software package, if you will. Can you talk to us about, you know, that sense of injustice and unfairness, and how that sort of informs our actions here?
Sure, and it's definitely genetic. I mean, in my talks, I like to use this video clip from Franz Duval's research with these capuchin monkeys.
Oh, the grape video.
I
love that one.
Yeah, so these monkeys, for your listeners, are they're trained to swap a little pebble for a piece of food. And, you know, by the time they run the experiment, you know, in the day, they're hungry, so they're motivated. And so they run over and get a little pebble and give it to the experimenter, who gives them a slice of cucumber, and they like cucumbers. But they like grapes even better. So they'll work harder for grapes. They'll swap, you know, like, say, two stones for a grape versus one stone for one pebble for a slice of cucumber. Anyway, in this famous experiment, you know, in there's two side-by-side capuchin monkeys in a transparent cage there, and the one gets a slice of cucumber and he eats it, and the other one swaps and gets a cucumber, and then the next one, in the next round, the other monkey gets a grape, and so the first monkey sees this, oh, he got a grape, oh boy, and he runs and gets his pebble and gives it to the experimenter, and he's looking forward to getting this grape. And instead, he gets a cucumber slice, and you can see he is not happy about this. He throws the cucumber slice back at the experimenter. He pounds on the cage floor. He rattles the cage walls, and, you know, now these are small brain monkeys. They don't have language. They can't say, "Hey, that's not cool. I am not pleased." But they can express those emotions through their behavior, and it's clear that what their actions are saying. And there's lots of examples of that. So the fact that we're separated by tens of millions of years in evolutionary history with capuchin monkeys tells us that the sense of fairness is deeply ingrained in all humans. And we know from these experimental behavioral games that are played around the world with not just Western culture people, but in Eastern cultures and in traditional societies and farming societies and herding societies, everybody has a sense of fairness. And when somebody gets something more than you, and it isn't clear why they got it, the immediate impulse is to think they got it unfairly. And really, historically, even in, you know, just the last, say, couple thousand years, that often was the case. You know, the system was hugely rigged, you know, through kings and priests, you know, getting the unfair share of the goods from the commoners, who, you know, the whole system has always been rigged. So all we can say about our system is that, well, it's not as bad as it used to be, and that it's getting better. And the whole idea of constantly tweaking our governance system is to try to lower the barriers to entry for everybody and to make it as fair as possible, which is why we have insider trading laws, for example. Same thing with, doping in sports. You have the rules, you try to enforce the rules. It's not a perfect system.
Indeed. And I would say that at this point in history, as we look around what's really happening across the world, we might say that science has brought us really far, and we would love for it to continue. There seem to be some countervailing forces always. So I guess what's the old saw that, science advances one funeral at a time. There are certainly some elements now, perhaps in our education system or otherwise, that might lead one to suspect that science is in sometimes getting a bad rap. In some cases, we have organized PR firms that are actively undermining what I consider to be science. So first, the definition of a skeptic is a person who's inclined to question or doubt all accepted opinions, but you're promoting something called skepticism. Perhaps that's something different. What is the difference?
Yeah, so by skeptic, I just mean the scientific approach to claims, and most scientists are skeptical by nature, not by human nature, but by dint of their training, because science starts with the null hypothesis. It starts with the idea that whatever your claim is, it's not true until you prove to us otherwise. And, an example I use that everybody's familiar with, if you think you have a drug to cure AIDS or cancer or whatever, you can't just send it to the FDA and ask for their approval without submitting your studies. Where are the peer-reviewed studies? Where's the journal articles? Where's your epidemiological evidence? Where's the controlled double-blind experiments? Something. You can't just assert that something's true. You actually have to prove it. And so the FDA will not grant, you permission to sell your drug until you prove to them that you do have the evidence that your drug is real. Okay, so it's always like that. You think Bigfoot is real? That's nice. Prove it. Show us the body. You want to name a new species in biology, you actually have to have a type specimen, a physical specimen that we can all look at. Grainy photographs, blurry videos, and anecdotes about things that go bump in the night, that's not evidence in science. So we start skeptical, and then we go from there. And it's not like skeptics and scientists are curmudgeons and don't believe anything. I mean, just watch any science show, pick up any science book. There's tons of things that scientists believe, from the Big Bang theory to quantum mechanics to evolution, germ theory of disease, plate tectonics and geology, tons and tons of theories that are believed in that sense because the evidence is there. So another analogy I make is, are you a global warming skeptic, or are you skeptical of the global warming skeptics, which would make you a believer? So skepticism is not just you just go into it and you don't believe anything, period. It just depends on the particular claim and the evidence for it. I might be skeptical of global warming. I once was. Now I lean towards skepticism of the global warming skeptics, because I think the evidence for global warming is pretty strong. So that's kind of a way to think about it.
Now, I note that you were once a skeptic of global warming, but then new facts came to your attention and that skepticism experienced a conversion of sorts. So I'm interested in that process of how, if I could paraphrase what you said, skepticism, then it's really more, it's a method, not a position. It's saying, listen, until the facts come in, I'm going to hold this view. When new facts come in, I might hold this view. So take us through that journey of conversion. You were skeptical in the first place, but you shifted. What caused that shift with global warming for you?
It was really starting to look at the primary literature, the scientific papers. Cumulatively, to be honest, I'd been a skeptic a long time, really since the 70s when I started college, when, the doomsayers were making these claims about, the end of the rainforest and the hole in the ozone and we'd peak oil and running out of minerals, running out of gas, overpopulation, billions of people would die. None of this happened. By the 90s, I thought, these guys are doomsayers. I think they've gone too far here. I'm skeptical. But I didn't really pay that close of attention to the research on global warming in particular. until I was at TED, my first TED in 2006, before TED was a big thing. And Al Gore gave his lecture on, you know, the inconvenient truth. It became a movie later, but that was the, you know, his slideshow, his keynote slideshow that he became famous for. That's where he gave it there. And I saw it and I went, huh, okay. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. I better read more about it. So it wasn't that Al Gore turned me into a global warming believer, but he stimulated me to at least read the primary literature and science. And I did, and there's just tons of it. So we did Issues and Skeptic on it, you know, pro and con by global warming skeptics published in there. And, you know, I gave it a fair shot on both sides, but I just came to that conclusion that, you know, that it's very probably real and very probably human caused.
Now, you know, it's fascinating. I saw you most recently at Freedom Fest 2016 in Las Vegas, where you were part of a mock trial where the claims of global warming were being both prosecuted and defended. Tell us about the experience for you, and how did it turn out? What'd you learn?
Oh, well, Mark, I've been going to Freedom Fest for years. Mark Skousen is a good friend of mine. And, you know, he talked me into doing the mock trial. We have to remember, it's just kind of for fun. It's sort of a show. It's entertaining. Okay, that's fine. So they actually have a jury and a judge. Michael Medved was the judge, and they handpicked the people from the audience as a jury. And so they tried to convict me of exaggerating the evidence. And the jury was hung at 6-6, so I was acquitted in that sense. So I feel like I won, which was my second victory of the day, because earlier in the day I debated Dinesh D'Souza on the Bible, good book or bad book, and I won that one. I converted more people to my side by a show of hands before and after. So it was kind of a double whammy victory for me. I felt pretty good about that. But of course, that's not how science works. It's not done by debate or vote. You know, when we talk about the consensus in climate science, it isn't a democracy. It isn't that we're basing our truths on how many people think it's true. No, it's that the people that are most qualified to assess the evidence have come to a sort of a consilience or a convergence of evidence toward one conclusion. So I cited a study I wrote about in Scientific American that the number we often hear, 97% of scientists believe in global warming. Mm-hmm. That's not actually correct. It's a study found that 97% of 11,000 published papers concluded that global warming is real and human caused. What about the other 3%? You know, maybe they're right. Maybe the 97% is wrong and the 3% is right. It's happened before. But the authors of this paper pointed out that there was no convergence of evidence in the 3%. In other words, they didn't all conclude that it's due to sunspots, it's due to volcanic activity, it's due to misreading of the Earth's temperatures because the thermometers were in cities instead of out in the rural areas. Nothing like that. They were all over the board, whereas the 97% all converged to, you know, the same lines of evidence over and over and over. And the reason that's particularly powerful is because these are different scientists working in different areas. They don't even know each other. They don't go to the same conferences. They don't publish in the same journals. Some of them are physicists. Some of them are meteorologists. Some of them are ecologists, geologists. You know, they have just lots of different fields. And so it's not like they're meeting on the weekends to get their story straight because, you know, we gotta destroy capitalism and free trade. You know, no, nothing like that at all. That's also what helped turn me around, was that, you know, so many scientists from so many different fields who don't work together, don't even know each other, keep coming to this conclusion over and over again. That tells us that it's a fairly robust theory.
Indeed. You know, I had an interesting experience sitting towards the back of the audience at that trial where you were on trial there. And a gentleman in front of me, when he was presented with, you presented some carbon dioxide data that came from bubbles that came, you know, out of the ice cores and, you know, went back a number of years. And he just flatly shook his head and said, blah, blah, blah. That was his rejection method. He's like, no, blah, blah, blah. And he didn't believe it. But then there was this former Princeton professor who came on and said, oh, by the way, we have CO2 data that goes back 65 million years. And that shows that it was higher once. And this guy shook his head up and down and said, yeah, how about that? So he loved one piece of data, hated the other. Presumably, both came from scientific methods. One confirmed beliefs, one ran afoul. And therein lies the difference in his reaction.
Yep, that's right. You have to accept evidence even when it goes against your belief. So this is the problem with certain areas of science. When they bump up against moral foundations or worldviews that are important, deep worldviews, religion, politics, economics, ideology. I mean, most people accept most of science. So it's not like Republicans hate science. No, they don't. They love science. They use science, technology all the time. It's only certain areas like creationism, because of the theory of evolution, feels like it's threatening our religion. Well, when I point out that it doesn't have to threaten religion at all. I mean, you can be a Christian and believe that evolution was the means that God used to create diversity of life. Oh, okay. And in fact, lots, millions, millions, many millions, tens of millions of Americans believe that. American Christians believe that. The statistics are about 45% of Americans believe that evolution was God's way of creating life. Okay, I'm an atheist. I'm a materialist. I don't accept that, but I'm happy to let, you know, give them that if that's whatever it takes for, you know, improving science education. And so with global warming, there's this sense that if it's real, then the government's going to impose these draconian laws that will restrict free trade and capitalism and business and the economy, and we'll go to hell in a handbasket because of that. No, I don't think so at all. First of all, I don't think that's the solution. I think markets can solve the solution. People like Elon Musk, electric cars, whatever. If there's a way to make money capturing carbon dioxide, some entrepreneur will do it. And, you know, so I say, you know, just, you know, Katie bar the door, let people have at it, solar panels, whatever. But the deeper point is that it's true whether you want it to be true or not. And so let's look at why it is you don't want it to be true and diffuse that bomb. You know, it's not going to take away your worldview. It's not a threat to your ideology.
Well, in that vein, then, let's turn now to your new book, The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. In there, you present evidence that scientific rationalism is responsible for moral progress. First, is that an accurate way to capture that? And second, what exactly do you mean by moral progress?
That's an accurate assessment. And by moral progress, I mean things are getting better in the long run. Follow the trend lines, not the headlines. I mean, if you, as we're speaking, you know, this tragedy in Munich is unfolding on the news right here in front of me, you know, six dead, you know, another shooter, who knows, could be terrorism, could be a nutball, whatever. If all she did was watch the news, it would seem like things are bad and getting worse. What are you talking about, moral progress? So we have to look at the long run, the long term, over the course of centuries. I really start centuries or even millennia ago, and look at how things used to be compared to now. And so I think of it as three steps forward, two steps back in terms of progress. There's always going to be enough bad things to happen to fill the evening news with bad news, because that's what the news does. But if you look at the long-term trend, the expansion of civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, animal rights, the abolition of slavery, the abolition of torture, workers' rights, children's rights, you know, there's just lots and lots of ways that we've tweaked the system for more people to have more prosperity, freedom, liberty, and choice than ever before. You know, you and I as men would have had a pretty high probability of dying violently if we were living in the Paleolithic, as, you know, these small bands of hunter-gatherers that were constantly at war with each other, constantly fighting over land and resources and women. And, you know, it was a dangerous place to be. And, you know, we just don't have that anymore. I mean, the raw numbers, like from World War II, are staggering, but the percentage of the population that dies violently is much, much lower, orders of magnitude lower than it was thousands of years ago. So in the long run, things are getting better. There is an arc to the moral universe, as Dr. King said, which inspired my title, The Moral Arc. And by reason in science, I mean that the idea that we should try to solve problems in a rational, systematic way, that really began with the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment. I mean, it begins with Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, and the idea that the universe is knowable. It's governed by natural laws we can understand. And then from there, it just trickled down into biology and economics. You know, I mean, the original economists were really scientists. You know, working in areas unrelated to the economy. But they, you know, François Quesnay, the advisor to the King Louis the 14th in France, he's the guy that coined the term laissez-faire, leave him alone. He said the economy is like blood flowing through a body; it needs to flow openly, freely. And if there's too many obstructions, it's causing disease. Too many taxes cause disease of the economy. That's where that idea comes from. And the idea that an economy or a polity is governed by principles that we can understand and apply, that's what we've been doing for centuries. So that's what I mean by that.
So this is a moral arc then that you're describing where we build upon past progress and off we go, even though we seem to have some temporary setbacks like ISIS seems to be a little bit of a throwback. And so you said an important word in there, though, about the Paleolithics. They were fighting over resources, be that land, food, women, whatever the resource was in question. I want to get your opinion on how much the moral arc is indeed due to a relative abundance that people can experience, and what might happen if, in your mind, to the moral arc, if suddenly humans encountered something like you were talking about in the 70s, if we did experience a shortage of resources, since most wars, even Paleolithic and modern times, are wars of resources in one form or another, what would happen to the moral arc, you think, in a time of declining or stagnant resources?
Well, two things. First, it's an intuitive idea that if life is good, then there's moral progress, and if life is harsh, then things get worse morally. But it could easily be argued the other way, that if you're mistreated, if you're poor, if your life is nasty, brutish, and short and miserable, maybe you're more sympathetic and empathetic with people that are also in your plight, so you're less likely to be violent to them. It could go either way. So the question is, historically, did it happen? And the answer is the timing's not quite right. For example, some of the most brutal treatment of other peoples happened during the Roman Empire at its height, when, you know, it was very prosperous, all the way to some of the Arab states today, where they have unfathomable amounts of wealth, and yet they have the worst track record of civil rights. So it's not necessarily true that as life gets better, we're nicer to each other. That said, you know, I mean, if we ran out of water, yes, of course, that's going to, you know, cause some conflicts locally. But I think globally, the expansion of the moral sphere has been due to other things, not so directly related to prosperity. I mean, prosperity has more indirect causes. So, for example, democracies are better than theocracies and autocracies for a lot of reasons, not the least of which economies are more likely to flourish. And so wealthier countries can spend more on healthcare, education, and so on. And so an educated populace is likely to be more economically prosperous, and so it feeds back on itself. The rich shall get richer, the Matthew effect. And, you know, so those are hard to untangle. There's so many, it's a thick web of causal variables going on there. Democracy, free markets, education, health, you know, they're all going upward. So it's hard to pin which one is the main cause.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just finished a book called reading a book called Why Nations Fail. Interesting hypothesis in there. It has a good explanatory track record for why some nations succeed and others don't. And in there, I think the main conclusion would be, if you have inclusive political institutions, meaning, you know, there isn't just a tyrant and things don't corruptively end up in the hands of a few, that's marker number one. Number two, you need to have free markets and free access to capital, and there has to be a level playing field. That's why I think that it's really absolutely critical that we understand things like where does this moral progress come from? Why do things succeed and fail? Because there are, in my estimation, certainly some dark clouds on the horizon for things like freedom, which is why I attended Freedom Fest, was to, you know, to really understand what are the trends in play, what are the forces. Certainly there have been some things that I consider to be counterproductive to inclusive political institutions and free markets have developed of late. And of course, these things have to be, you can't just count, you can't, what would I say, you can't just assume they're going to be there. These are things that have to be carefully guarded, I would suppose.
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing inevitable about the arc of the moral universe bending toward justice and freedom and prosperity. The whole thing could turn around. This is not a Hegelian Marxist type, end of history. We're almost nothing. The whole thing could go south. Yes, for sure. But the further down the path you go, the less likely it is to make a massive reversal like that. Just think about, for example, everybody's up, worried about Putin. But what are the chances of Putin cobbling together something the equivalent of the USSR in the 1960s and 70s, all those states? Chances are pretty slim of that happening. Same thing with, slavery. Slavery is illegal in every country in the world now. It's still practiced a little bit in the form of slave labor and sex trafficking, but it's illegal in those countries, and the laws are just not enforced because the governments are corrupt. So it's really a problem. It's more of a pragmatic problem of law and order rather than convincing people that slavery is bad. So we've won those battles. So the chances of any group of people voting back into their constitution slavery is pretty nil. It would require like a massive extinction of most of humanity and starting over for those kinds of institutions to come back. So I think we've made so much progress that we can be fairly optimistic about that. So we really talk about sort of fine-tuning the system here and there, as you said, setbacks in freedom here and there. If you follow the Freedom House survey every year, it goes up and down. They have this many countries are free, and this many countries are partially free, and these are not very free, and these are definitely not free. And they have those categories, and that kind of waxes and wanes. It's not at the all-time high right now. It's down a little bit. So why? Why did that happen? Well, Syria, for example, there's been an uptick in homicides and in Chicago. Why? There's been an uptick in battle deaths because of Syria. Well, why? So it really comes down to the details of figuring out the specific cause of the problem in that particular area to reverse the trend back toward it in a positive way.
Well, Michael, in closing here, I have to ask, I ran across just a really charming story you wrote a while ago about an event that shook your skepticism to the core. It was around your wedding. I'm wondering if you would relate that experience and if you have had any other thoughts about it since.
Oh, sure. Yes. Well, it was a little bit out of character for me, but it happened. So I wrote about it. This is in one of my columns in Scientific American about the day my wife and I got married here at my house. She moved here to LA from Cologne, Germany. So this is quite a step for her. And the steps that led to our getting married on this particular day were kind of random, and it just happened because of immigration law and stuff like that. Okay, better to do it now than later. Okay, let's do it this particular day. Boom. So it was kind of upon us quickly, and there was no time for any of her friends or family to be here. So she was feeling kind of lonely and bad, that I had my friends and family here and she had nobody. And she was raised by a single mom and a grandfather. So, and a grandfather's passed away now, and she was close to him. And so she shipped over this radio that they used to listen to music on, classical music. And it didn't work, and I couldn't get it to work. I spent time trying to get it to work, new batteries and checking the wiring, that sort of thing, just dead. So I put it in the back of a drawer in the bedroom. And anyway, long story short, we were getting ready. All of a sudden, we heard music playing in our bedroom. It's like, I don't have a stereo system. Maybe my iPhone's on or something. No, it's not the iPhone. Laptop? No, not the laptop. Neighbors? No, not the neighbors. Where is this music coming from? And it was like right underneath the printer fax machine. It's like, wait a minute, these things have a lot of functions, but they don't have a radio, do they? So sure enough, we opened the drawer, turned out it was the radio playing. Totally random, came on at the very moment she called me to the back of the bedroom to just have a moment of a moment of privacy because she was feeling so bad. And there was her grandfather's radio playing classical music. And, played the rest of the day and night, went dead the next morning, and it's been dead ever since, despite my efforts. So, what does it mean? I don't know. I'm not going to take the leap that, oh boy, grandfather was channeling through, this particular radio station. Who knows? But it's the timing, the emotional component to it. And since I wrote about that, I got hundreds of letters from people saying similar things happened to them. So, you know, I think we should keep an open mind about the fact that anomalous experiences can have an effect on people's lives, and that it's okay to think about it and experience it. We don't have to go crazy and, you know, and project some new age theory about quantum physics and consciousness and life after death. Just enjoy the mystery and leave it at that. And even a skeptic scientist like me can say, you know what? I don't know everything. Science doesn't know everything. Who knows? I don't know. And I'm just going to appreciate it.
Well said. You know, I'm a scientist myself, a PhD in neurotoxicology. And you know what, Michael, I used to know it all. The older I get, the less I know. Science is uncovering mystery after mystery. Just for myself, looking at how the gut biome exploded across our consciousness and awareness, there's so much yet to learn. So I love keeping that the mystery open. It's healthy, I think, to understand we don't know everything by any stretch. Yeah. So we've been talking with Michael Shermer. He is the founder and publisher of Skeptic Magazine and the author of the new book, The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.